I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
It all began in 1961 when President John F. Kennedy declared it was time to invest in space exploration and ultimately put a man on the moon. What happened in the years following is what my guests this hour call the largest and most important marketing and PR case study in history. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we learn how the U.S. government and industry worked hard to win over the public hearts and minds to garner support for the Apollo space program, an endeavor that would cost more than $25 billion. What are your memories of that time? Was it worth every penny? Why did our collective interest in space exploration seem to wane following the Apollo 11 mission that put Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon? We invite your thoughts this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. My guests are David Meerman Scott, a marketing strategist and advisor, and a speaker on topics including marketing, leadership, and social media. And Richard Jurek, he's marketing and public relations executive and president of Inland Marketing and Communications near Chicago. He joins us today from the studios of WBEZ. Together, they're the co-authors of Marketing the Moon, the Selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
And Richard, thank you for being here. Oh, and Richard, I had the wrong fader up. Thanks again for being here.
Okay, I appreciate it. It's glad to be here.
Describe, first of all, each of you, your personal interest in space. I understand you're not necessarily scientists or astrophysicists. You're marketing experts. So what got you into space? David, we'll start with you.
Well, I am absolutely the opposite of being what you just described. I'm a proud liberal arts graduate, actually. I was 8 years old during Apollo 11, and I remember as an elementary school student that they would wheel in these rickety old metal devices with televisions, black and white televisions on top, and we would watch aspects of the Apollo program, liftoffs and splashdowns, and even some of the times that they walked on the moon or they were cavorting in their lunar rovers, and I was absolutely fascinated by it. But then I kind of lost track for about 30 years of what was going on, and my interest was rekindled when I was in a Barnes & Noble and I ran across a book about Apollo by Andy Chaikin. I read it, I became fascinated, and then I started to collect artifacts from the lunar program, and I actually have some items that have been used by the astronauts as they conducted their missions and even on the surface of the moon. And then that led me to think, as a marketing guy, wow, you know, what an amazing marketing task this was to convince the American public to spend 4% of our national budget and have 2% of our national workforce to get 12 people to the surface of the moon. And Rich and I spoke about that and lamented the fact that no one had talked about the marketing aspects. And then we kind of said, duh, well, what about us? We should talk about the marketing aspects. And that's how the book Marketing the Moon came about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go on.
Go ahead, Cynthia. I'm sorry.
No, well, I was going to ask you.
Yeah, from my perspective, too, I'm also a child of the Apollo generation. I'm just a year or two younger than David, but my earliest memory as a child is actually sitting on the green shag rug of my parents' south side of Chicago living room and watching a Saturn V rocket sit on the launch pad on a big Zenith black and white TV, and my mother being in the kitchen on the phone with one of those long cords ironing so she can keep an eye on me and iron and talk on the phone at the same time. And that sort of image is embedded in my brain. And growing up with Star Wars and the original Cosmos TV series and all of that, space had been a theme in my life going forward. And while professionally I ended up working in marketing, similar to David, my interest was rekindled later in life when I learned you could actually meet the astronauts. David and I are both very involved in the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, which was started by the original Mercury 7 astronauts. And we go down every year to Florida to their fundraising campaigns, and we meet with the astronauts and talk to them. And as marketers, instead of asking the usual questions, which were, how do you go to the bathroom in space? What was it like to be weightless? Did you see the face of God? We asked questions like, were you scripted? Did you get any kickback money from Tang? Those type of questions that you wanted to know, and they were never asked those questions before, or very rarely, and they would light up, and that led David and I to have additional conversations about this, and to his point, that light bulb moment, that duh, we really should write this book because it is full of stories that no one really has explored before.
Was it hard to track down people and to get that information for your book?
You know, it wasn't at all. From the perspective of the people that we reached, were unbelievably eager to spend lots of time with us. The challenge, though, are that the participants are getting up in years. The Apollo astronauts are now in their early 80s. The people who worked in public relations and public affairs for the contractors and for NASA, we spoke with them. We spoke with some journalists who covered the program. You know, they were also certainly getting older, although some of them were a little bit younger. We actually spoke with one radio reporter who was only 18 years old when he covered Apollo 11, so he's a little bit younger. So that aspect was tough because a lot of the people we would love to have been able to interview are no longer, unfortunately, with us. But when we did reach out, people were like, oh my gosh, you want to talk about marketing of Apollo? This is great. I'd love to talk with you. And they were like, you know, we would talk for an hour and a half, and they're like, I got more time. I can talk longer. They were so eager to tell their stories. You know, people had never asked about what it was like to cover Apollo. When we talked with a Reuters reporter, we talked with a New York Daily News reporter, and people had never asked the folks that ran public affairs in NASA, you know, how did you do this? How did you make this happen? And the answer is there's a lot of different reasons, but one of the things that they did, which was so brilliant, which we learned, which was different than what lots of people had assumed, is that NASA had an amazing partnership with the contractors, with companies like Boeing and Raytheon and IBM McDonnell Douglas. And these were the sorts of companies that built the components for Apollo. And then that led us to the people in the marketing departments of those companies. And that was a story that had never really been told before. So there's a lot of really interesting things that we were able to learn as marketers, because nearly everybody else who's written a book about Apollo, and there's been a lot, have focused on the space aspects or the personal stories of the astronauts. But we took a completely different angle and ended up with stories that have never been told, documents that have never been seen, photographs and images that had never been published.
Now, did the Apollo program require that marketing, or was it just a side effect of a pretty cool endeavor?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The roles were sort of bifurcated. If you think about it, NASA had the responsibility. In fact, it was embedded in their charter when NASA was formed in the 1950s as a civilian organization, in contrast to the Soviet military and CLOSE program. The NASA program, which really had its starts in the military with the U.S. Air Force in post-World War II, with the von Braun team in Huntsville, brought over from Germany and working towards launching missiles. But the United States made the brave approach of, one, making it a civilian program, and two, embedding in the charter that they would openly communicate not only to the United States but to the world what they were doing. And so the NASA folks had the responsibility of what we would look at as the PR part, informing the public about their activities and what was going on. It was the contractors that took on the mantle of the marketing responsibility of trying to promote their businesses. You know, if I could get the Americans to the moon, I can certainly get your next intercontinental ballistic missile to the next continent. So and we can't forget that there was a war going on at the time, too, in the 60s, and it was a time for a lot of these organizations to latch themselves on to really a positive message, something that a lot of Americans and people around the world were looking to as a positive step forward. So it was something that they could get out in front of, talk about with a smile on their face. And so the NASA folks and the contractor marketing folks really complemented each other, one doing the PR, one doing the marketing.
And David, did you have anything to add to that?
Rich said it very well.
Okay. Well, you know, how much of this had to be marketed to politicians as opposed to the public in order to get the massive amount of funding that would be needed?
I think it was actually happening both at the same time, simultaneously. And it was very, very interesting from that perspective because, you know, politicians knew that if the American public was behind it, that they will darned well better be behind it as well. And then as well, the American public said, well, geez, this is something that's really seems great. I mean, we should really do that. And of course, there were pockets of people who said, you know, there's poverty in America. Maybe we should be spending money on something else. But for the most part, people were really behind the program. And what we really came away with is that this was a government program that the U.S. government got right. I mean, you know, we listen to public radio and we watch the news and we magazines and newspapers, and there is very little going on these days that the government gets right. I mean, just watch the fireworks that happened in the last 2 days because of the shakeup in Congress with Eric Cantor losing his reelection bid, and how people are just saying, oh my gosh, you know, there's so much bad going on with the government. You know, they can't roll out health care without having any problems, or whatever, you know, whatever example you choose. But you look at Apollo, it was a resounding success, and it was, it had the support of the vast majority of the American people through the whole period. And we believe that that was partly due to the fact that it was very cleverly marketed, and I don't say that in a way that's in any way negative. I mean, some people have a negative reaction to words like marketing and sales and public relations, as if it's trying to convince someone to do something they don't want to do. It's not that at all. It's simply the idea that NASA and the contractors and the astronauts and journalists worked in concert to deliver a story to the American people and members of Congress that resonated with them. It was the amazing images that were provided. It was something as seemingly simple as live television from the moon, which in fact was as difficult a problem as actually getting to the moon. To have live television in the later missions, live color television coming from the surface of the moon using 1960s technology. Wow. Now, that was a marketing challenge. Mm-hmm. But in effect, what it did was it sold the idea that this program is really valuable for the public. And Congress was like, wow, we got that one right. And as Rich said, it was during the era of the Vietnam War. So getting something like this right, you know, was a good feeling for people when they had to deal with all the issues around, you know, the conflict in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, and you know, it was one of the, not only the greatest marketing and PR case studies of the last 75 or 100 years, but it really is an amazing case study of public-private partnership where the, you know, if you think about it, the over 400,000 people who worked on the Apollo program across the United States, a good almost 75% of those people were the private contractors. And if you think about the infusion into our economy, not only of jobs and intellectual capital, but the vast advancement in technology, the miniaturization of TV cameras, the advancement of communication networks to communicate from the moon back to the Earth in real time. If folks out there will just pull out their smartphones from their pocket and look at it and think, just think that during the Apollo program, the command module had the computing power that was several million times less powerful than what they have in their pocket. Their smartphone is really the legacy of Apollo, because it really is no coincidence that Intel was formed in 1965 when about 60% of all computer chips were going to the space program, and that Microsoft and Apple were formed in the 1970s really by kids who were inspired by the technology and the communications revolution that was going on as a result of the space program. So again, in terms of just public-private partnership, in terms of not only marketing the moon to the American people, but marketing American technology and advancement to the world, but also the impact to this day of the innovations created by Apollo is just absolutely astounding.
I think I remember David sharing a statistic in one of his a speech that I was watching online. 1 kilobyte of memory in that in that computer that that existed in the 1960s. I can't believe it.
Yeah, and if you saw the speech, I think I was the one I was delivering at the Business Marketing Association in Chicago.
Yes.
I actually own one of the those modules, and I held it up. It 1K of memory from the Apollo guidance computer actually weighs more than my iPhone. And I mean, you can just imagine that difference. And you know, going to the moon is unbelievably remarkable if you think about it today. But when you add the component that we did it with 1960s technology, it just becomes, it becomes science fiction. It's science fact because we did it, but it's almost science fiction when you look at it from the vantage point of 45 years later.
Yeah. We're talking with David Meerman Scott and Richard Jurek. They are marketing experts and co-authors of Marketing the Moon, the Selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. And we want to hear from you. Do you remember the marketing of the moon? What were you thinking at that time? Were you excited about the possibilities? Do you think too much money might be spent on the space program? According to public opinion polls of the time, apparently not everybody was on board with this. Did the marketing help change your mind, though? Did it get you excited? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you want to write a song about the moon, walk along the crater.
I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with David Meerman Scott and Richard Jurek, co-authors of Marketing the Moon, the Selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. They call it the single largest, most important case study in marketing and PR in human history, and we're finding out why this hour. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. You give pop culture, science fiction specifically, a lot of credit for providing a good foundation for marketing the missions. How did they do that?
Well, it's rather interesting. I mean, traveling to the moon had been the thing of sort of juvenile fiction for hundreds of years, and people had always created that fantasy of what would it be like to go to our nearest neighbor to the stars, and people wondered, was there life up there? What would it be like? Even during the Apollo program, in the early stages, they didn't know if they'd be bringing back moon bugs and germs and other things. So there was a lot we just didn't know. And, you know, the moon is mythological to a lot of people. It's romantic. It carries very different symbolic meanings across many cultures and many places. So it's woven into the literature and the cult in many cultures for hundreds and thousands of years. But in 1865, a man by the name of Jules Verne wrote a book called From Earth to the Moon, in which he really layered in a lot of science and an almost plausible way of getting to the moon, which has amazing parallels to the actual Apollo program. Debating whether or not to fly from Florida or Texas and actually launching from Florida 3 men to the moon and getting to the moon in a capsule and then coming back and landing in the Pacific Ocean. The parallels are rather amazing. And a number of key people, people like Robert Goddard in the United States, read that book over and over again, and it sparked their imagination. It got them to think about how would we actually do it. And many of the early rocket scientists, Oberth, Goddard, and others who are responsible for the early development of the technology that got us to the moon, all of them have talked about how they read that book from cover to cover and wrote comments into it. So science fiction really was the start of moving towards science fact and moving forward. And then those books and those ideas influenced the science fiction of the 1930s, the Buck Rogers and the space patrols of the 1950s, that really created a base, while within more of a juvenile community, a base or a sense of space exploration that really energized a lot of the future people that would become astronauts and the relatively young people who worked at NASA, these 20 and 30-year-olds who are creating this technological revolution that got us to the moon.
David, did you have something to add?
Well, the other aspect of that that became very interesting for us was how Wernher von Braun, the German rocket scientist, who basically was a Nazi. I mean, he worked in Germany and he devised the rockets that were launched from Germany to reach London during the World War II. He was brought to the United States and ended up leading the effort to develop the Saturn V rocket. But he actually became in partnership with Walt Disney. And it just seems like such a radical partnership, oh my gosh, between this German Nazi who's building rockets for the United States and Walt Disney. And they actually collaborated on putting together various things that reached the American public. They were involved with some of the Disney television shows that came out in the 60s, also Disneyland's Tomorrowland. Was partly as a result of them working together. And it was interesting how Walt Disney had a bit of a hand in the very initial aspects of getting the American public interested in space travel. It just seems, viewed from today's vantage point, seems so radical and interesting. And it's a little known aspect of how the idea of going to space was something that was on people's minds in the late 50s and early 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually the Disney program Man in Space, which aired before NASA was even formed as an organization. The day after it premiered on television, and think about it, this was the time of when you only had like three channels on TV. So to get a major program for over an hour focused on the reality of actually getting people to space, and Walt Disney coined the phrase, he wanted his people to create a program that had science fact, not science fiction. He did not want it to be fictional. He wanted it to present what it would really be like to get to the moon. What would it take to leave our planet? President Eisenhower actually requested a copy of the film the day after it aired, and he showed it to the folks in the Pentagon, and they all got excited. And in fact, a senator on the U.S. Senate floor after NASA was formed and our space program got underway thanked Walt Disney on behalf of the American people for helping push it along. So it's an amazing part of the story that we really hadn't paid attention to before.
As we collectively think back to that time and all the discoveries and other innovations that we were making, there's a lot of nostalgia surrounding it, largely, I think, positive feelings about it. But take us back to that time and what was public opinion really like over those years, particularly between the time of JFK's speech in 1961 and the initial moon landing?
Well, there was if you think about what was going on in other aspects of popular culture and then look at it from that perspective, you had sort of the rise of the counterculture movement. And that's something that I've actually personally chronicled myself. I wrote a book called Marketing Lessons from the Grateful Dead. the idea of sort of flower power and the summer of love and all that rising up, which was in direct contrast with the button-downed, crew-cutted military people that were involved in the Apollo programs. So there's a very, very interesting dynamic at work where on one hand you had the clean-cut brigade, and on the other hand you had the hippies. And in fact, they were more similar than they were different. The clean-cut guys from the military involved in Apollo, you know, they had their drinking and smoking and chasing skirt incidents that we learned about and that never really made it into print during that time, although it would have today. The other thing going on, of course, is the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War was escalated during that period you described from 1961 through, the first time we went to the moon, which is Apollo 8, 1968, and the first time we landed, Apollo 11, 1969. And you think about all the bad things going on. 1968 was also the issues going on with the Democratic National Convention, and those sorts of things are all happening in the world. You know, the good thing going on, the thing that people could rally behind, the thing that people could, that Americans were proud of, the thing that we were doing better than anybody else on the planet was getting us humans to the moon. And so it was a very, very fascinating time in history to go back and look at. From our perspective, we have a number of documents that have never been seen before in the book, a number of photographs and images that had never been published before in the book that chronicle these kinds of ideas that, you know, Apollo taken in its history, in the time period of the day, it worked brilliantly. I'm not sure whether you could pull an Apollo project off in 2014. I know it, given the evidence of us trying to get to Mars and not getting there, I suspect you probably couldn't do an Apollo project today. But during the time, it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, Richard, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to ask you a follow-up. Why do you agree with that assessment, and why is it so hard to get another mission like this off the ground today?
You know, it's amazing. If you look at the Apollo story arc, which changed as society changed throughout the American space program, you'll see that while it lags a bit, it's an amazing mirror of American society, at least in the majority. If you look at the beginning of the space program, it was a result of the Cold War in a Cold War fight between the closed Soviet militaristic program and the U.S. open civilian program, and this global fight, if you will, between East and West. As it moved on, and as we actually landed on the moon, the story shifted from one of sort of Cold War bravado to science and geology. And one of the most famous and iconic images from the moon, the Earthrise photo, or the blue marble photo of seeing mm-hmm. the fragile Earth just hanging in that deep blackness of space, really affected society. And it's no coincidence as well that you had the environmental movement starting in the 1970s in the whole Earth catalog with the blue marble on the cover. And, you know, it's famously said that we went to space to explore the moon, but what we really discovered was the Earth. And we started to look inward as a society. You had the civil rights movement going on. You had a lot of the counterculture that David talked about. And NASA went through that period. And after exploring the moon, we started to focus our programs more on low Earth orbit and environmental sciences and looking to the Earth. As to whether or not we could do it today, I kind of agree with David. I think the challenge that NASA has and that the global space effort has, whether it's private or public, is analogous to what's going on in the media. You have, when you only have three channels on television to choose from, attention and focus is pretty easy to generate. When you have 300 channels plus the internet plus everything else that is competing with your attention, it's harder to generate a base of support. So while there's a lot of enthusiasm for space, looking at the new relaunch of the Cosmos TV series, or you look at the popularity of films like Gravity, it's hard to get the support base and financial support within politics and with society at large for any one singular space program, because all of our attentions are so divided and there are so many different competing interests within the public and private space. So I agree with David. I think it's very challenged. I think NASA recognizes it. I think many people involved in the private space enterprises recognize it. And they're all trying to carve out their niches, just like the media companies are doing, to appeal to their various bases of interest for support.
That's Richard Jurek. He is one of the authors of Marketing the Moon, the selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. His co-author, David Meerman Scott, is also with us, and we invite you to join the conversation. What are your memories from the Apollo mission? What are your thoughts about the state of space exploration today? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, or you can leave us a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Coming up after the break, I'd like to ask the guests about the specific lessons they've learned from their research of this so-called greatest marketing case study in human history, and why public interest in this area seemed to wane after the moon landings in 1969. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
What a moment. Man on the way to the moon. So we've seen another beautiful Saturn launch, but this one will never be known in history or by those of us who watched it as just another Saturn V launch. Not if all goes well, because this is the flight from which man will first set foot on the moon. We almost glibly toss that line away now, man on the moon. But by golly, just think it over.
That's Walter Cronkite anchoring the liftoff of the Apollo 11 on July 20th, 1969. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're talking with a couple of guests about the selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. They're co-authors of a book called Marketing the Moon. David Meerman Scott and Richard Jurek are both marketing experts and space enthusiasts, and we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. David and Richard, I wanted to ask you, why haven't we manned any missions to Mars, or why haven't they taken off despite being talked about since the 1970s?
I would suggest that we actually made a mistake with marketing the moon. And it's not talked about very often, but in our research, what we found was that the story from a very broad perspective was marketed essentially as what I would call a quest story. And you opened the show at the top with John F. Kennedy's speech. The goal was to send a man to the moon and return him safely to Earth. And we did that. Yay! Everybody jump up and down, light the cigars, drink the champagne. We accomplished the goal. The problem was, after the goal was accomplished with Apollo 11, then we hadn't yet talked about what comes next. And in fact, there were a number of other Apollo missions, Apollos 12 through 17. Of course, Apollo 13 didn't make it. The other ones did. But those were not marketed in a way that made any sense to the American public, because it's like, well, we've already gotten to the moon. You know, what are we doing next? And I think that legacy in fact harmed us going forward for the next several decades, because then we ended up in low Earth orbit with the space dump truck, you know, the space shuttle, going around and around and around and around and around and around the Earth, not doing anything really substantial. I mean, of course, there's tons of stuff going on with the space shuttle, and it was a fine program, but we never got beyond low Earth orbit with the space shuttle. And I think that was partly a marketing fall down. We didn't articulate to the American public and the people who are going to foot the bill in Congress that we need to go beyond low Earth orbit.
Yeah, and you know, and it's kind of a structural problem that NASA faces today. Our book has met with a lot of positive reception from the folks in NASA, and we've gotten some pretty good conversations back and forth with them. And you know, they point out that the problem that they had back then is the same problem that they have now. They are not allowed to market in the traditional sense. And again, David had said it earlier, we're not talking about marketing in sort of the pejorative, oh, get you to do something you don't want to do. We talk about marketing more from the professional end, which is it's managing a product life cycle. think about packaged goods marketing, where they design and invent to meet a need and push forward benefits that solve a problem, and then they manage that product through the life cycle of the needs of their customers. And they have to pay attention to all products go through a life cycle. It gets introduced, it peaks. You see that with a lot of things, and then it starts to tail off as innovation and other products come in and compete for filling more advanced needs that generate out of fulfilling those basic needs. And what NASA did very, very well leading up to Apollo 11 and then throughout was embracing what we today would call brand journalism, the PR part of using ex-journalists within their public affairs department to not push an agenda, but to educate the public and drive the facts of the situation out to the news in a way in which the news organizations could take it, repackage it, and use it in their news cycle. But there was no real marketing going on, to David's point. What comes next? How do we extend that product life cycle? What benefits are we deriving from it, particularly given the dramatic change going on in society at large? The space program evolved out of societal needs, geopolitical needs at the time, and kind of lost a little touch with that. But as current NASA folks would say, whenever they attempt to market as opposed to do traditional PR, which is communicate and educate, they are reminded that's not their job, and they're reminded by folks that that's the job of the president and Congress. And unfortunately, they're subject to that political football that changes every 4 to 8 years in terms of direction, and it's a little hard to drive programs of this magnitude when the opinion of that changes every 4 to 8 years. With Apollo, this is going to sound crass, but I think people need to recognize it for what it is. Apollo was the vision of a dead president that nobody wanted to walk away from. Even if people felt that it might be a waste of money, what we heard to a person that we interviewed, even journalists who were kind of against the space program at the time, said, we wanted them to make it. We were all in it together, at least for that first landing, because that vision, that quest story that David talked about, was so important to the American psyche at the time.
Well, and as I recall, there were some political implications there as well. And it maybe if there was some reigniting interest in within the Department of Defense today, would we see a different fate?
You know, it's very interesting that over the last month, Rich and I have spent some time with Buzz Aldrin, of course, second man to walk on the moon, part of the Apollo 11 mission. We actually spent time with him in Pasadena, California, more than an hour one-on-one talking about, because he is such a Mars fan. He has dedicated the last 20 years or so of his life to figuring out how humans can get to Mars. And as a member of the first lunar landing program, he has a very interesting sort of pulpit to be able to talk about this. And he absolutely agrees that it's a challenge of communications. It's a challenge of marketing. It's a challenge of how do we harness the will of the American people and Congress, and in fact, you know, the nature of your last question, the military, to figure out how can we get ourselves to Mars. And there's a lot of things that Buzz Aldrin is trying to do. He's got a book out about Mars. He frequently speaks in public and gets on the media about Mars. Without that kind of effort, and in fact without the effort of private contractors also getting on the bandwagon, I don't know that we'll ever do it.
Let's take a call from Mark in Colfax. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Back in the summer of 67, 68, when I was 12 and 13, a friend of mine and I had built a simulated spacecraft out of a shed in the backyard. And we had TV cameras, the newspapers, science teacher certified that we went in on a certain day. We went 14 days the first summer, 20 days the second summer. And then the Milwaukee Public Museum at the time was trying to put together a space center where they wanted to accumulate all this information and things. To raise money for that, they had a booth at the Wisconsin State Fair, and they used us for publicity. They had created a place called Lovell City on the Moon, and they sold lots to that city to raise money for the Space Center, which I guess not enough interest because it never happened. But I'm just wondering if you had heard of that type of thing going on at the time.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, you know, Mark, that's a great story, and that's something that David and I, in a couple chapters in the book, we explore. Obviously, you can't explore every angle and every story, but it was amazing how folks who weren't directly attached to the space program marketed and felt attached to it. You know, even airline industries who obviously weren't flying to the moon. Pan Am, for example, started a reservation system for those who, when they eventually would start flights to the moon on a regular basis, you would become moon card members and you would get in line to order your tickets and be the first ones to book flights. So a lot of that was going on. But for Mark's particular experience, what I find interesting is that NASA had a space mobile program in which they went out to all the schools. They had all of these educators fill vans with models and with scientific experiments and would drive around the country visiting schools to generate excitement in what today we would call the STEM programs of science, technology, engineering, and math to really generate excitement in the younger generation, because those would be the future engineers, the future astronauts that they felt they would need for the ever-increasing space programs of the future. And that excitement, which Mark expressed, got picked up by the media, the news, local museums. And it's one of the things that NASA also got right during the Apollo program. They embraced what we would call brand journalism today, in which they hired ex-journalists and then they courted the media because it was such a new frontier and a lot of new technology. They created symposiums and education opportunities for the media, and the media became just as enamored and just as excited. You know, Walter Cronkite, which you had played earlier in the segment, they hunted out these stories and looked for them and generated excitement as much as NASA did. And the media became an extension of NASA's public relations arm and really were a part and parcel to it.
It's interesting how Mark is ahead of his time by 45 years, because now they're trying to figure out, if we do go to Mars, how are the group of astronauts going to be able to live together for 2 years in a little cramped space. And they're actually planning on sticking volunteers into a little cramped space for 2 years. So maybe Mark wants to volunteer for that.
Well, we had talked earlier about how you had referred to this Apollo mission as the largest and most important marketing and PR case study in human history. As marketing professionals, just real briefly from each of you, I'd like to know how you've used what you've learned from the Apollo experience and applied it to your career.
You know, the thing that really strikes me is the aspect of real time. And so with the beginning of the manned space program, with the Mercury and Gemini programs, they didn't really focus on the idea of instant and real time. And with Apollo, they did. The idea that you can have live television in the spacecraft, you can have live television from the surface of the moon, you can have live audio of the Houston to spacecraft conversation, so that, you know, you could, with public radio, you could broadcast as much as you wanted of this. That live aspect was actually a very, very tough thing to get through, because a lot of astronauts and a lot of the engineers didn't want it to happen. Now, I draw a complete parallel to where we are today. The idea of live communications today, the equivalent, is things like Twitter and Facebook, and the idea that everything is happening instantly online. And so many companies are afraid of live communications, just like the astronauts and the engineers during the Apollo missions, lead up to the Apollo missions, were scared of having real-time television, real-time audio, because they were worried about having to become performers, and they were worried about watching their language as they were speaking. And the same thing's happening now. And fortunately for all of us, there was live television from the moon. And fortunately for the companies that adopt it, there is now live communications through social networking like Twitter that companies can take advantage of, but that same fear needs to be overcome.
Yeah, and from my perspective, too, there were just so many lessons to be learned. We had uncovered so many stories that no one had really paid attention to. I was recently at a university giving a lecture on the book, and I figured, you know, a few people from the community would turn out, and maybe a few of the professors would turn out, and maybe one or two of the students. And the auditorium was packed with a cross-disciplinary group of students from very different departments. You had design people who showed up who were interested in all the marketing materials and sort of the vintage 70s communication pieces and how did they get their message across. You had history people, journalism people, PR people, marketing people, engineering students, and all looking at the Apollo program from a different lens, all of which crystallize in our book. And for me, the thing that runs through all of them is this idea that content is king. We hear about that in the social media world, and David really touched on it very clearly in his last comment. But the content of the Apollo program was just so rich that you didn't need to do any of the pejorative spinning. You didn't need to package it. What you needed to do is facilitate it and kind of get out of the way and make it easy for those who are your influencers, those are who are part of your distribution channel, to be able to access that information. And it wasn't always easy. There was an internal struggle with sort of the military mentality of this is secret. And that battle between having a closed program and an open program, we have some seminal documents which in the book which really show the struggle of what I would call press freedom, as the ex-journalists of the Public Affairs Department were fighting with sort of the military-minded astronauts and NASA management who wanted to edit transcripts, mm-hmm. who wanted to hold back information, not out of any meanness or out of anything bad, but just out of the idea of, you know, that's kind of secret right now. Maybe we shouldn't do that. But there was that push to keep it live.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Annalisa in Green Bay. Hi, Annalisa. What's your question?
It's a fascinating program. My question is, we have kind of a lack of interest or kind of fear of science and math in this country. And you've talked a lot about these educational efforts, but I just wonder if you think that this whole space program could have been used more effectively to raise our level of interest and our sense of competence, you know, for everybody in science and math.
Thanks, Annalisa. What's your response, David?
Hi, Annalisa. So I think during the 60s and 70s, that the best and brightest coming out of the schools absolutely wanted to do science and math. There was a sense during that period that science and math was where the leading and most interesting things were going on, and that's where the smart people wanted to end up. And you really had people gravitate to something like the Moon Program. Oh my gosh, I can be part of the Moon Program. There were 400,000 people involved in the Moon Program in one way or another. Today, as you allude to, Annalisa, there's, you know, the best and the brightest, you know, they're not necessarily going to math and science. They want to be investment bankers and make money on Wall Street. They want to, you know, become a rock star and make their money that way. And it seems like we need to have something that people can hang their hat on, young people can hang their hat on and say, yes, this is something I want to be a part of. This is something that is worth my time and effort, and this is something that I can make a career around.
And Richard, we have just a minute to get your thoughts on this, too.
Yeah, and to cascade on David's point, David Brinkley, the journalist, had said at the end of the Apollo program, and he kind of helped turn the tide against it when he said that, we can get a man to the moon and bring home rocks, but we can't deliver the mail on time. And he kind of argued for building down the American space program. And I think that we lost the forest for the trees with that. Instead of looking at it as an amazing public-private partnership of amazing project management, management to shepherd all 400,000 of these people to get us to the moon? And what can we learn from that? And how can we energize society? We simply pull the funding and move somewhere else. So it's this lack of vision, this lack of marketing that vision that keeps us from exceeding our expectations.
Well, thank you both for being with us today. This is a great conversation.
Thanks, Cynthia.
David Meerman Scott and Richard Jurek are co-authors of Marketing the Moon, The Selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. Richard joined us today from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing the hour, and to Bill Martins for on-air production. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
In other words,